Hello everyone, and welcome to today's ICHD 10 Codeathon event. The event will now begin with an introduction from Alexis Johnston with Ketchum Public Relations.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Alexis Johnston from Ketchum Public Relations, and I'd like to welcome you to today's ICHD 10 Codeathon event. In an effort to make sure that providers and other industry professionals are preparing for the transition to ICHD 10, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the American Academy of Professional Coders are collaborating to bring you this event to help you get your coding questions answered. AAPC certified trainers are ready to assist you and are looking forward to your great ICD-10 questions. Before I get started, I just wanted to give you an overview of how today's session will run. If you take a look at the schedule slide up on the screen, you will see that we are going to kick off the Codeathon event with presentations on ICD-10 from Denise Benning of CMS and Rhonda Buchholz from the AAPC. Their presentations will be followed by a brief wrap-up where we address some of the common frequently asked questions, and then we will start the online-only Q&A session with the ICD-10 trainers from AAPC. At that point, the audio portion of our session will end, but the online platform will go live. To ask a question during the online Q&A, just select the Q&A button on the top gray bar and type in your question. The AAPC trainers will address your questions as quickly as possible. Lastly, I want to let you know that during today's audio portion, all phones will be muted so that you can hear the presentation very clearly. Today's presentations are also being recorded. The audio portion and transcripts will be posted to the CMS website at www.cms.gov/ICD10. And I'll just give you that website one more time. It's www.cms.gov/ICD10. So they'll be available on the website within 2 weeks. Please note that there are no handouts for the event, but all the materials will be available on the CMS website, as I just mentioned. AAPC is offering 2 CEU credits for participating in this Codeathon event. The CEU number is AAPC04131103233A. And I'll say that one more time. The CEU number is AAPC04131103233A. And attendees must stay for the entire time to receive credit. If you need any assistance during this event, please call 1-877-283-7062. And that number is at the bottom of the slide on the screen. Now I'd like to turn it over to my colleague Lauren Hoffman, who will introduce our first speaker.
Great. Thank you, Alexis. I'd like to introduce Denise Benning. She's the Director of the Administrative Simplification Group at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Office of eHealth Standards and Services in Baltimore, Maryland. Denise authored both the agency's proposed and final ICD-10 rules, and her areas of responsibility include CMS's ICD-10 Program Management Office, HIPAA Transaction and Code Set Enforcement, and HIPAA Administrative Simplification. She's going to be speaking to you today about why the transitions to ICD-10 and version 5010 are occurring, what exactly is changing, who is affected by the change, tips on how to prepare, and the resources that are available from CMS. So without any further ado, I will pass it on to Denise to start the presentation.
Great. Thank you, Lauren, and thanks to everybody today who's joining us. Good afternoon, and for our colleagues on the West Coast, good morning. This is Denise Benning with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, Office of eHealth Standards and Services, and I want to thank everyone today for taking time out to participate in this event. Particularly, I want to thank the AAPC. When we first had this idea a number of months ago, they really jumped on it and developed it into the event it is today. As you know, we had around 2,000 slots open for this particular event, and they quickly filled up. And I think it's just very gratifying that everyone has an interest in learning more about this. You know, we here at CMS talk about this all the time, and we often think that perhaps everybody knows about ICD-10 and 5010, and you know, from the response that we've gotten today, we know that that isn't necessarily the case, so we're really excited about this opportunity to partner with AAPC and use their coding expertise to get some of your specific coding questions answered. So many times when we have these calls, we don't have the time or don't have the subject matter experts on hand to answer individual coding questions. So we'll try and do a little bit of a general overview for everyone to level the playing field as to why the transitions are being made. And then again, when we get into our webinar section, deal with our specific questions. So again, our thanks to AAPC, Deb Greider, Rhonda Buchholz, and all the other AAPC leadership for helping us with this. So let's talk a little bit about what this is all about. The topics that we're going to cover today, as I think Lauren went over, what is changing, who's affected, some of the key details about version 5010, why we're making the changes, getting ready, important dates, and of course resources to help you all prepare, and there are lots of them out there. So exactly what's going to be changing? Two different changes are going to be taking place. The ICD-10 diagnosis and procedure codes are going to be transitioned from the current ICD-9 version over to ICD-10, and along with that, there's going to be a change in the HIPAA standards. The current version 4010 and 4010A1 are going to be upgraded to version 5010. And these standards are used to basically electronically transmit claims and other administrative transactions. Now, I know that that sounds very technical, and perhaps to a lot of providers on the call, they may not recognize these particular terms, but especially when it comes to 5010, if you ask providers if they ever send an eligibility inquiry or a claim status inquiry, they know exactly what that is. Version 5010 is basically what's under the hood. It's a software change that upgrades the system to really bring it forward and accommodate a lot of the changes that have been necessitated by changing industry needs. So we're talking about going from 9 to 10 on the International Classification of Diseases, and from 9 to 10 PCS. You'll see currently when you have ICD-9, you'll have Volume 1 and Volume 2, and then Volume 3, which is basically your procedure codes. Well, we're breaking that out into ICD-10-CM, which is your diagnosis codes, and ICD-10-PCS, which are your procedure codes. The version, again, version 4010 and version 5010A are the current HIPAA standards, and they get upgraded here actually as of January 1st of 2012. So who has to do this? Anyone who's covered by HIPAA, and if you're a healthcare provider, you pretty much know what HIPAA is. Healthcare providers who conduct electronic transactions like eligibility inquiry, health claim status, that sort of thing. Payers, and that includes Medicare and Medicaid. We're the largest insurance group, if you want to call it that, in the world, so we are also subject to the HIPAA provisions. Clearinghouses also must be are covered under HIPAA, and they have to adhere to the HIPAA rules. There are some non-covered entities that use the ICD-9 codes currently. Some business associates, some vendors, workers' compensation programs, life insurance companies. The majority of the industry is changing over to 5010 and ICD-10, and while these non-covered entities aren't obligated or aren't mandated to make the changeover, we've been getting anecdotal reports that they are going to accommodate the new code sets. Just from a practical perspective, it's very difficult to have an entire healthcare industry using one set of codes and some segments of it not. So, as I say, nothing official, but we're getting anecdotal reports of inquiries being made and some of the workers' compensation programs in particular working towards making the transition to ICD-10. So let's talk a little bit more about version 5010 and ICD-10. Version 5010 replaces the 4010. And again, although you may not be necessarily familiar with the current standards, they're in use every day in the United States. These standards are really the platform or the foundation used in practice management or other software that allows you to electronically send and receive information to and from a plan to verify eligibility, to submit a medical claim for reimbursement. Many professionals are familiar with the transactions but again, not necessarily the mechanism that gets it there. And as I say, it's always what's underneath the hood. You don't necessarily need to know what's there, but you need to know that when you turn the key, the engine works well. 5010 and 4010 pretty much are the same way. The new version is important for a number of different reasons. And the most important thing, at least from an ICD-10 perspective, is that you cannot have ICD-10 without version 5010. Because in version 5010, for lack of a better description, there's a toggle switch that basically tells the software and tells the systems you're using ICD-10 codes because the format's a little bit different. So it's really important that version 5010 is in place first. Version 5010 fixes the deficiencies in version 4010. On our next slide, I think we changed it. Okay. Version 5010 fixes the deficiencies in 4010, and a lot of these were caused by changing business needs in the industry. For example, Medicare Part D prescription drug program. What the industry had been doing was kind of a patchwork approach. It was making a lot of workarounds or quick fixes to try and make the standards work with the current business needs of the industry. So when the updated version came around, the version 5010, it accommodated a lot of those changes. But it also does a number of other things. It increases processing time. It will increase make more efficient office workflows. You'll get more information back when you make an inquiry. So you're spending less time on the phone following up on where something is or an eligibility for a patient. And of course, we all know that the less staff time spent on administrative types of transactions and procedures, the more time that can be spent in patient care and also saving costs. So we can't continue to use the 4010 and the 4010A. It lacks functionality, and most importantly for us, it does not accept the ICD-10 codes. So what's our implementation timeline for this? For 5010, all covered entities must be fully compliant by January 1st of 2012, and that's just about 6 months away, which is not a whole lot of time. What basically compliance means is that providers and plans need to be able to conduct these HIPAA transactions successfully. The compliance dates are firm. They're not subject to change. So as of January 1st of 2012, if we're not using 5010, then that is a non-compliant transaction, and most likely it will be sent back and asked for 5010 or it will be rejected. Medicare actually started accepting test claims with the basic version of 5010 in January. Now, since that time, there has been a second version of the 5010 standard, what they call an errata version. And what happened with this was the standards development organization that was responsible for version 5010, called X12, they started getting reports in as people started using and testing and preparing for version 5010. But there were some glitches, perhaps a typo here or a misplaced space there that made it difficult to use the standard. So they accepted all of these what we call maintenance changes, and they issued what they call an errata. And this month, Medicare fee-for-service started accepting both test and production claims into our systems. And we will continue to accept both 4010 and 5010 through the end of the year. Of course, once we hit January 1st of 2012, we will accept only version 5010. But it's important for us to test because that makes sure that all of your transactions will be going through smoothly and that reimbursements will be coming back timely without any problems. ICD-10 is the next transition that comes after 5010, and it provides the opportunity to accommodate new procedures and new diagnoses unaccounted for in the current ICD-9 code set. As I think most of you who are familiar with ICD-9 know, it produces only very limited data about patients' medical conditions and hospital procedures, And the space is really limited. We're literally running out of room. Most of you are probably familiar with the chapters of ICD-10, and you know it got to the point where we were putting cardiology codes in the I section and vice versa, and that really slows down coding. If you're looking for a particular code, you've got to literally know where to look. It's not very intuitive at this point. Many of the categories are full. So the ICD-10 codes allow for much more space for expansion, and considering all the advances that we have in terms of now laser surgery, arthroscopic surgery, different procedures, now we really need to have that kind of expansion room given the kind of advances that we're looking at in medicine. So it's not just a matter of expanding a field and adding more digits on. The expansion of the number of codes allows for greater specificity and exactness in describing a patient's diagnosis and in classifying inpatient procedures. I believe the ICD-10 will accommodate newly developed diagnoses and procedures, innovations in technology and treatment, performance-based payment systems, more accurate billing. Now, under ICD-9, according to a RAND study, only 1 in 5 hospital claims are paid completely without the need for additional questions or paperwork, and we're hoping that the use of the more robust ICD-10 code sets will really cut down on that. In addition, we'll have better data to improve the management of patient care, to better describe new diseases. You know, we're the only Big 7 country that hasn't made the transition long ago to using ICD-10, and we're also the only country in the world that uses it for reimbursement purposes as well. So it's sometimes difficult to compare other countries' experiences with ICD-10 to our own because each country has its own version and uses it for different purposes. But we feel especially when it comes to tracking pandemics and being able to share health information across borders that this will really bring us into line with the rest of the world. Okay, your ICD-10 code set, as I said before, consists of two parts. You have the CM for your diagnosis coding, and it now has laterality. It will describe left versus right, whether an encounter is initial or subsequent, whether it's routine or versus delayed healing, union versus non-union versus mal-union. So, for example, if a patient comes into an office and has been diagnosed with a brain tumor, the ICD-9 code would give you a general code for that particular diagnosis, but in ICD-10, it will give you more specific diagnosis coding by allowing you to choose between left and right hemisphere and whether this is an initial occurrence or a reoccurrence. And it's not that this is going to change the way a medical record is notated, because providers always provide as best a description of patient conditions and procedures and treatments as they possibly can in the medical record. This just reflects better that detailed level of medical record notation. So you're not writing to the code. You're basically coding to what's in the medical record already. Another example, a patient comes in with an arrhythmia and needs to have a pacemaker inserted. 9 doesn't have a code for a pacemaker, but the ICD-10 PCS code set gives you a distinct code for a number of different devices and isn't as nearly as general as the ICD-9 code set. Now, we're talking about a jump in the number of codes from approximately 15,000 codes in ICD-9 to about 150,000 codes in ICD-10. And I know when we talk about those numbers, people panic a little bit thinking they're going to have to know all the codes. Well, you know right now that if you're working in a provider office, and especially in a specialty clinical area like cardiology or dermatology, you're using only a subset of the codes. It's very similar to a phone book. All the phone numbers are there for you to access. However, it's likely that you're only going to be using a couple of numbers. And the most frequently used codes are the ones that you're going to be putting on your super bills and on your cheat sheet, so to speak. You won't need all the codes all the time, but they're there if you need them. The other important thing to note is that the CPT codes that are used for outpatient and office procedures are not affected by ICD-10 transition. So what you're going to see is the ICD-10, especially the PCS codes, are used for inpatient hospital procedures only. There are a number of tools that CMS has developed to help the industry, and they can use them if they wish. The most important of these are what we call the GEMS, the General Equivalency Mappings. And they're a crosswalk between ICD-9 and ICD-10, and they're a forward crosswalk and a backward crosswalk. You can look up an ICD-9 code and be provided with the most appropriate ICD-10 matches and vice versa. Just as you find multiple words in a dictionary, you'll find multiple definitions depending on how the word is used. It's then up to the clinician to determine which is the most appropriate match. Again, you're going from 15,009 codes to around 150,010 codes, and in many cases there's a one match to many match, but only about 5% of the codes represent 80% of the most commonly used codes. So again, you won't use every number, every code, but it's nice to know that they're all there. The GEM is a useful tool, but when you're talking about a large volume of claims, you're talking about a payer having to adjudicate millions and millions of claims a year, it's not a substitute. It is a tool, but it's not a substitute for a system changeover to ICD-10. The Affordable Care Act, which is, I think you all know is health care reform, required the Secretary of HHS to task the ICD-10 Coordination and Maintenance Committee to have a meeting before January 1st of 2011. And the reason they asked for that meeting is they wanted to get stakeholder input regarding the crosswalks between 9 and 10. They wanted to get as much public input as possible to make appropriate revisions so that the ICD-10 code set would be pretty much ready to go by the time October 1st of 2013 rolls around, which is the compliance deadline. And they've also made another stipulation. Congress put in the health care reform bill that the crosswalks should be posted to the CMS website as revised based on public input and feedback, and that they should be treated as a code set for which the secretary has adopted a standard. So basically, what does that mean? That means if you're going to use a crosswalk, the Affordable Care Act tells you that you should use the version posted to the CMS website. And that's really important. It's important because if we have plans or whoever else doing proprietary crosswalks, then it's going to be very difficult for providers to know which particular version of the crosswalk they should be using for whatever payer they're trying to file a claim with. So if we have a standardized crosswalk, it's going to make things a lot easier and a lot more consistent through the industry. So that's why that provision is in there. So again, if you choose to use the GEMS, you should use the ones posted to the CMS website. There are going to be updates and changes to the code sets, as I think all of you who are familiar with coding know that there are two updates made every year to whatever code set it happens to be in force at the time. But we wanted to also make sure that there wasn't going to be a change in the code sets just prior to the implementation that would require people, systems to change and coders to make changes as well. So there's going to be a partial code freeze to eliminate that kind of uncertainty. And again, this was in reaction to industry asking for at least a stop point that they could count on in order to get ICD-10 properly loaded into their system. So the last regular annual update to both ICD-9 and to the current ICD-10 code sets will be made on October 1st of 2011. There'll be a partial code freeze that will last until October 1st of 2014, and then you'll see regular updates to ICD-10 will be resuming. There'll be limited updates to both code sets on October 1st of 2012 for both ICD-9 and 10, and then on October 1st of 2013 for ICD-10 only. limited updates will be reserved for addition of major new technologies and diseases only. There won't be any other changes allowed. Again, trying to limit the numbers of changes so that everyone can go forward with a stable set of ICD-10 codes. So what are we doing here at CMS? Obviously, we have a lot of work to do because not only do we have to change over all of our systems, we have to change over and assist the states, our Medicaid agencies, with making changes to their systems, and we also have to make policy decisions that may impact the industry. We have a program management office here at CMS for ICD-10, and we've been working now for the past few years to identify all the touch points here at the agency and look at our internal policies and processes and see what the cross-cutting issues are. Our ICD-10 steering committee meets every other week, and what we've been doing lately, and I think that this is really significant, is we've gotten past the planning stages of ICD-10, and we're really starting to work on the work of implementation of ICD-10. We're starting to see change requests go out to our Medicare Administrative Contractors, our MACs. We're starting to get input back from them as to what changes they feel their systems will need and how long and how much that will take. We are starting to gather all of the questions that we get from events like this, from teleconferences, from JAD sessions with our contractors, from emails that are just submitted to us, of policy questions that we need to make decisions on. And what we're doing is we maintain an internal log of decisions to be made. We've actually gone through the log the past month or so and are starting to come up with answers to many of the questions that I know you all have regarding CMS policy. And once we get change requests issued to our contractors, we will announce those decisions and our policies through our FAQs on the ICD-10 website. But we have to wait until that happens to make sure that our MACs don't have any questions or determine that perhaps there may be some contraindications to whatever policy decisions we might be making. So once we get those CRs issued, we'll start to post these things to our CMS website. Transitioning to ICD-10 is a major initiative, and when we first started out on this, it was really compared to the Y2K initiative. Well, as we have found out, it's bigger than that because it doesn't just affect a field, it doesn't affect a date. It really affects systems, business processes, manuals, and while with an organization as large as CMS, we face all of those issues, it's still, no matter what size you are, if you're a small provider office or a multi-physician practice or whatever else, a small community hospital, it's important to get organized early. This is not a change that can be made a month before the compliance date. This is not a change that is just going to be phased in. It's a one-time date where we basically throw the switch and everything changes over. Given that, there are steps that everybody can take to prepare for ICD-10. You know, we talk about organizations attaining management support and putting a structure in place such as an ICD-10 committee, and that's great if you're a larger organization. But if you're a small doctor's office in Beloit, Kansas, call a staff meeting. Ask everybody where these codes are popping up in their work. Talk to your vendors. Talk to your software vendors who are carrying your physician or your practice management software. Ask them, when are you going to be able to deliver to me updated software that we can start loading and testing? Organize your organization, assign responsibility to people for certain tasks. Check with your professional associations to see what information they have available. Obviously, the larger the organization, the more complex. This doesn't have to be complicated, but you do have to pay time and attention to it. And again, we're finding that our ICD-10 website is getting a lot of hits. CMS, www.cms.gov/ICD-10, no hyphen. And also the AAPC website, the association websites. We just did some research showing that the first place that the industry is going is to their respective association website to get information on ICD-10. So that's going to be really critical as you move forward. There's lots of information out there. Please access it as early and as often as you possibly can. One of the things I know that coders and even those providers who aren't necessarily professional coders but still code have questions about is training. Training, when we did our proposed rule back in 2008, was a major concern. How do we get everybody trained? Where do we go for training? And I know we have some suggested curriculum of the basics of what you should be looking for. And these are just some of the titles, clinical definitions, workflow changes, how to code diagnosis and inpatient hospital procedures. It's important for any organization to identify what your staff training needs are going to be relative to coding. Identify the staff in your office that code, and it may be physicians, it may be nurses, it may be medical assistants. Just because you don't have the title coder doesn't necessarily mean that you don't code. So in talking to organizations like AAPC and others, the recommendation is to schedule the training 6 months prior to October 1st of 2013, which is the ICD-10 compliance date. And we thought that was strange, quite frankly, when we first had this discussion, because we figured, gosh, the sooner you get training, the better. But, of course, our friends at AAPC showed us the error of our ways and recommended that, you know, if you don't use it, you're going to lose it, and that's very true. You can get your training a year out, but if you're not using the codes, then you fall out of practice with them, and your early training may end up necessitating some refresher training. So the recommendation from our experts is that there's a lot of training out there available through associations, online courses, webinars, on-site training, but do it around 6 months out. And again, if you're short on resources, you know, you don't have the time or the money to be able to afford to send a staff to training, again, take advantage of online training or collaborate together. Get a number of offices together, have one or two people go for training and then come back and train the rest. That can really help you to stretch your training dollars and your resources. So basically, here are the dates, plan ahead. January 1st of 2011, providers and payers should already have started their external testing of version 5010. And what that means is that during this time, they really should be testing with their payers, their plans, to see you know, if what they have loaded in their systems works. Can they successfully conduct a 5010 transaction and have it sent back properly? And while not too many were ready to test at that point, now that we have the errata version of 5010 in place and Medicare fee-for-service has started accepting production claims and test claims with version 5010, I think you'll see a lot more payers starting to say that they'll be ready. So look, you know, contact payers, find out when they're going to test, what they're going to test, and how you get that started. On January 1st of 2012, 5010 goes into full implementation. All electronic claims must use version 5010 as of that date. Around a year and a half later, you've got full implementation of ICD-10, and that means any claims for services provided on or after October 1st of 2013 must use ICD-10 codes only. There's no dual coding. You can't put an ICD-9 and an ICD-10 code on the same claim. If you submit with an ICD-9 claim, most likely it will be returned to you and you'll be asked to provide the ICD-10 code. So again, you know, don't wait until right before those dates. Test early, test often, work with your vendors. You'll need the time in order to make sure that everything goes through smoothly. Obviously, any delays in these dates could really cause your organization problems in terms of workflow and in terms of reimbursement, so we very much want to make sure that all of these deadlines are met. So just to recap, compliance deadlines and transitions are mandatory. There seems to be some urban legends going on there that we would accept ICD-9 codes, that you could use either or after October 1st of 2013, and that's not true. You must use ICD-10 after October 1st of 2013. It's a big transition. The codes are structurally different, and again, it's going to take a lot of training and a lot of effort. But I think that in the end, considering all of the changes that it will affect, it definitely will require, will make a difference in the way healthcare is looked at. These are foundational, really, to all the other implementations that are coming around. So again, important dates to have your plans in place. Remember your dates: external version 5010 testing, full implementation on January 1st, 2012 of version 5010. Start your training around April 1st of 2013 for your ICD-10 CM and PCS. And then again, October 1st of 2013, full implementation. And again, on that date, there is no phase-in. Also heard some other rumors that we were going to allow payers and providers, if they were ready to start using ICD-10 ahead of time, to do so. No, it really would create chaos in terms of all the other systems that would have to be in place in order for that to happen. So we're sticking to the October 1st, 2013 implementation. There is no phase-in as there have been with some other HIPAA initiatives where you have a longer time for small health plans. No, everybody flips the switch on the same time. Okay. Let's talk very quickly about resources. We've mentioned before the ICD-10 website. We also have a listserv that you can sign up and get free information whenever anything happens on the website that's updated. We have specific links to Medicare fee-for-service providers, Medicaid programs, again, the opt-in to receive your email updates, and we continuously update this website with new tools and information throughout the transition. And in fact, we're going to be having some small provider, hospital, and some payer handbooks up there, hopefully in June, that will provide very simple directions of how to make an easy transition to ICD-10. So look for that in around a month and a half or so. Again, check your professional trade associations and explore what's available on their websites. Our industry update provides subscribers with timely information. Here's an example of what you'll see. You can opt in. I believe now we have approximately 30,000 people signed up for this, and it grows on a daily basis. Again, you receive updates on all the information that changes and important notices and reminders of where you should be in your transition planning. We also have lots of fact sheets. These are things that you can download, print off, and share at a staff meeting or a board meeting or again, just to use in your implementation. They just give you the basics of what you need to know and then refer you on to the website or other resources for more information. So these are a great resource, and as you can see, they cover a wide variety of things from medical practices, the transition, what you should be asking your vendors. So we keep adding to our list as needs are identified. We also are running a bunch of advertising in national publications. And these are running in national pubs like, you know, Healthcare Economics, all of the, you know, JAMA, all of the big publications. But we also made an effort to run them in state and regional publications like the South Carolina Family Practitioner, just to be able to reach physicians to say, you know, if this is coming, will you be prepared? Here's what it means, and this is where you need to go for more information. So we've been running these now for a number of months, and starting, I believe, in June, we'll also start running some more extensive online banner ads, and we'll see how those go as well. But again, just trying to raise awareness out there in the provider community and also in the vendor community. The message to the providers is ask your vendor. The message to the vendor community is your providers are going to be asking, will you be able to respond? So these have been a nice leveling field out there in terms of just raising general awareness among two key groups. So that's pretty much what we had to talk about today in terms of CMS. My email address is up there in case anybody has any questions. Again, I thank you so much for your time today. I think this is a really important initiative. It's foundational to healthcare reform. It's foundational to meaningful use. It really ties into so many more initiatives that are going to be looking as we look down the road in the future. So I hope that you embrace it. I hope that you look at it enthusiastically. And now I'm going to hand this off to, I think it's Rhonda, who's going to talk to you a little bit about what's available and through AAPC. Rhonda?
Yeah, that's right. I'm just going to give a quick update, give everybody some information about our next presenter, Rhonda Buchholz, Vice President of Business and Member Development at the American Academy of Professional Coders. She has more than 20 years' experience in healthcare, working in the reimbursement, billing, and coding sector. Rhonda is a lead member of AAPC's ICD-10 training and education team, which is charged with the development and training of curriculum on ICD-10 implementation and preparation for providers, facilities, and health plans. She's developed training modules for ICD-10-CM for all specialties for the AAPC and is responsible for all ICD-10 training and curriculum development for the AAPC and the new certified professional medical auditor credential for AAPC. Rhonda is going to discuss complex diagnosis coding examples, best practices and ideal training for ICD-10, as well as the tools and resources available from AAPC to help assist with the transitions. Rhonda?
Thank you. As Denise indicated earlier, one of the largest transitions that we have is going to be the jump in the sheer number of codes. And you can see in ICD-9-CM, we have about 14,000. We're going to jump or transition to 69,000, just slightly over 69,000, on October 1st of 2013. And as coders, that's the biggest sticking point in our heads. But this code set and the actual portions of it that we're going to be using is just one actual small chain in the link of events that need to happen in order for us to be successful in ICD-10 transitions. So this presentation is actually going to go down through the physician practice and all of those areas of impact or all of those changes that are going to need to happen. Then we'll get into some of those changes where you're going to see some format and structure changes with ICD-10 that you can keep in mind for you. We do believe that it is too soon to learn the code sets. However, the format, the structure, and having a general understanding is really important for us as we move forward and make that transition. So the first thing that I want to talk about is the physician's office and the map that we have that's available. So we're going to start in the manager's office. And so some of the areas of impact for the manager, and when I say that this manager is going to get hit hard, all of us in our own departments are going to be hard hit and really have to work towards making a transition. But the manager is going to bear a large brunt or a large responsibility of it. You're going to have to take a look at your new policies and procedures. So basically, any policy or procedure that's tied to a diagnosis code, your disease management tracking, your PQRI, any of those processes that you have internally are now going to have to be rewritten, revised, and reformatted for ICD-10. All of the contracts that you have in your practices need to be evaluated, whether they be vendor or payer, and updated as needed to make those transitions. So with your health plan contracts, if you have any type of language that's tied into them regarding reimbursement and a disease process or diagnosis, you need to reevaluate those as well. Vendor contracts, making the transition over to I-10 and what they can and can't handle and how that's all going to come into play. All of that, of course, is also going to require budgeting. Anything that we do, any software updates, training, education, new contracts, new paperwork, somehow that has to get paid for. So now is actually one of those times that we really need to have a long-term budget in our practice in healthcare. Now, I usually make the joke that in those smaller practices, oftentimes the process of a budget is whatever we happen to have in our bank accounts at any given moment. We need to actually think strategically through this and figure out where we're going to have to spend our money over the next several years in order to have ICD-10 implemented successfully. And, of course, on top of that, we're going to need to have some type of training plan, because basically every single person in your practice is going to need some type of I-10 training, whether it be just a slight overview of the changes that are coming down along the way, or as you go down through with your coders and billers, the more intense coding training in your clinicians. You need to determine how much training everyone in your practice is going to need, and then how are you going to get it done? The next area that we're going to hit is our clinical area. Our clinical area is going to see the majority of the changes. They're going to see changes to patient coverages. All of the health plan policies, payment limitations, all of those types of things that are tied in are going to need to be changed. New order forms for any diagnostic tests that we order, any labs, x-rays, think along those types of lines. ABN forms may need to be revised as they go down along the way. You're going to have to take a look at them and see how you have your setup, because your policies and procedures regarding when you're going to issue those are going to have to change to meet the new policy limitations that will be out there. Super bills. Think about whether you're in an electronic world or a paper world. All of your super bills, no matter what, are going to have to be revised. Depending on the practice that you're in, the paper super bill or encounter form may be impossible for us to transition to leaving the diagnosis codes on. There have been a lot of different practices that have actually taken their normal two-page super bill, which is one page front and back, where the one page is devoted to a diagnosis code, and suddenly these have expanded to, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 pages. Obviously, that's not a way to conduct business in the future, and we're going to have to find out how we can make that transition if we're going to stay with paper super bills. And how are we going to revise those? So these are all strategic areas that we're going to have to take a look at. Our health plans, of course, are going to revise all of our policies that are linked to either our local coverage determinations, our national coverage determinations, those types of things. Those forms are going to have to be reformatted, and patients are going to have to be educated to the changes that are going to come down along the way. Next, we're going to transition to the physician. There's going to be a greater need for specificity. It's going to increase dramatically with the use of ICD-10. Physicians are going to have to document laterality, stages of healing, weeks in pregnancy, episodes of care, and other instances in ICD-10 where we're going to make those transitions. And when we say that changes to documentation need to occur, it's not because we see or we feel that physicians are poor documenters. It's because the concepts have changed in ICD-10. And they're going to have to make sure that they now capture those nuances that are found in ICD-10 to make sure that they can actually accurately assign an ICD-10 CM diagnosis code. And our code sets are actually going to grow to over 140,000. Now, that's if you include ICD-10 PCS. So the physicians have to be trained on where those changes are going to occur and what needs to be included in their documentation. In the nurses' station, we have our changes to our forms. So think about that. Every single order form that we have has to be changed, revised, or completely redone or reformatted. The nurses are going to need to make sure that they document with the increased specificity that's going to be required to make sure that all changes can be captured. I'm sure there will be changes to prior authorizations coming down along the way. All of those policies on the prior authorizations are going to change to fit the new diagnostic codes. So it's going to require training and updates to all of the forms that are going to be out there. Lab is going to see significant changes. Oftentimes, especially in outside laboratories, we don't give them enough information in ICD-9 for them to be able to process the claims, and it results in numerous phone calls back and forth. Changes are going to need to be made, because now with a higher level of specificity, the labs are going to need to make sure that they gather that information and that we, on the physician side, give them those. There probably will also be new requirements for the ordering and the reporting of services as health plans go down through and revise their policies and procedures and update them for ICD-10 CM. Our billing and our coding are going to be significantly impacted. all payer reimbursement policies tied to any type of diagnostic medical necessity reasoning is going to have to be revised to fit ICD-10-CM. The billers are going to have to be trained on the new policies and procedures for ICD-10-CM. And we're going to have to run dual systems for quite some time. Now, as Denise indicated before, the transition to ICD-10-CM is included as part of the HIPAA standards. Now, there are certain entities, as she indicated, that aren't covered by HIPAA. Workers' comp is one of those. So for workers' comp, this is actually going to be one of those transitions where it's going to be state by state, carrier by carrier. So some states have some protections in place already where workers' comp is forced or encouraged through law to adhere to the HIPAA standards. Not all states have those policies and procedures in place. So there's going to be the need for dual systems, which means your coders and billers are going to have to run in dual systems for a period of time until everyone makes the transition. There's nothing to say that workers' comp has to make that transition. So you want to check and start looking now strategically to see what kind of plans they have in place to make those transitions, because if you're participating on panels, you want to know ahead of time, because this is going to be an administrative nightmare. You're going to want to make sure that they know what plans they need to bill ICD-10-CM with and ICD-9, because you want to make sure those claims go through so that they accept them right on the first time. Again, with our coding, we know we're going to transition over to the code set. So we know there's going to be changes in the book. Like Denise says, it's a big book, but you're not going to use the entire book. So for most of us that are in a limited specialty, we might only use a portion of the book. However, that doesn't mean that we're not going to have some changes that come down along the way that we're going to have to learn. There's a lot of formatting and structure that is different in ICD-10-CM than it is in ICD-9. Because of the higher level of specificity, for those coders that don't have a strong understanding of anatomy and pathophysiology, they might need a refresher on some courses that will help bring them up to speed with the higher level specificity that's found in the new code set. And keep in mind that they're also going to have to code in dual systems for some period while everyone makes the transition outside of the covered entities. Even the people who work your front desk are going to need some type of training. For those practices that might have been very detailed in their HIPAA privacy policies, they might need to be revised, and patients are going to have to sign new forms. It really depends on the structure and how far in depth you went with your HIPAA privacy notice. Updates will more than likely be required by your systems, and that may mean training on new ways of handling patient encounters and taking a look down through along that way as well. Another thing when you're talking about the waiting room is that patients will need to also be educated, because this transition will affect them and their coverages as well, so that might fall along on the people at your front desk as well. So they'll need to have an understanding of ICD-10 and what changes so that they can give a brief explanation to the patients that come down along the way. So those are briefly just the very easily identified areas of impact in a physician's practice. And those are the steps that you need to start looking at in those key areas, because implementation is really what we should be focusing on now. However, in order to successfully implement, we do have to have a good understanding of the codes and how they interact and relate. So I'm going to go over a few slides that are going to show you some of the differences in the translations so that you can have a good understanding of what will be coming down along the way. First and foremost, let's talk about diabetes. There were significant changes to the diabetes coding, and the majority of the codes are combination codes. So we actually have 6 diabetes categories in ICD-10-CM right now. So we have E08 for diabetes due to an underlying condition, E09 for the subcategory for drug or chemical-induced diabetes, E10 for their type 1, E11 subcategory for our type 2, E13 for other specified, and E14 for unspecified. Now, the thing to keep in mind with our diabetes is with the combination codes, we should actually have to use less codes to actually explain our encounter or the patient's condition. In ICD-9-CM, Usually we need two or three codes in order to complete the encounter. With the use of the combination codes in diabetes, you will see that a lot of times you can use fewer codes. So diabetes codes were expanded to include the classifications of both the diabetes and the manifestation. And so they, the terms and the codes have actually been updated to reflect all of the current clinical classifications that's out there on diabetes. Diabetes is no longer classified as controlled or uncontrolled. And we give you a couple of examples here. We have E08.22, which is diabetes due to an underlying condition with diabetic chronic kidney disease. An example there of a good combination code. E09.52, drug or chemical-induced diabetes mellitus with diabetic peripheral angiopathy with gangrene. So you can see where we give you some examples of the diabetes codes that are in there as well. The other thing to keep in mind is that for anyone that has been on long-term use of insulin, there's also a secondary code that we have to report with our E-codes as well, and that would be Z79.4 for the long-term use of insulin. Now, we talked about combination codes a little bit with our diabetes codes, but the combination codes extend well past that chapter. Because ICD-10 consists of greater specificity, we do have the availability of combination codes that are out there. And this is a hard concept for some people to grasp when we talk about the combination codes and having to use less codes or fewer codes on our encounters. Because when you think about going to 69,000 codes, you automatically think that it's such a difference from the 14,000 that we're using. A lot of times in ICD-10-CM, we can actually use fewer codes to capture the encounter and the true intent of what the patient was being seen for. Now, this slide just actually shows you a couple of other combination codes that are out there that requires a level of greater specificity. So we have I-25.110, which is arteriosclerotic heart disease of the native coronary artery with unstable angina pectoris. K50.013, which is Crohn's disease of the small intestine with a fistula. So now you can see actually with our Crohn's disease, we actually have the manifestations or the other issues that are going along with it combined into one code. And we have K71.51, which is toxic liver disease with chronic active hepatitis that's captured in there as well. Now, think about this. In ICD-9, we only have one code for complications of a foreign body that's accidentally left in the body following a procedure. In ICD-10-CM, we have 50 different codes for this that are available. So you can see where that's expanded on. And this example just gives you some different scenarios that are out there. So we have T81.535, which is perforation due to a foreign body accidentally left in the body following a heart cath. We have T81.530, which is accidentally left in the body following a surgical operation. Then you can see where we go down, where we actually have one that's following, or this is actually an obstruction, T81.524, obstruction due to a foreign body accidentally left in the body following endoscopic examination. We have T81.516, which is adhesions due to the foreign body accidentally left in the body following aspiration, puncture, or other catheterization. So these were greatly expanded to allow us to actually capture the detail of those complications. Another big change that you're going to see down come along the way is our coding of our fractures. Now, our fracture codes actually require a seventh character to identify if the fracture is opened or closed. The fracture extensions are listed here below, and so it's actually A is for the initial encounter for a closed fracture, B is the initial encounter for an open fracture, D is subsequent encounter for a fracture with routine healing, then we have G for subsequent for a fracture with delayed healing, K is subsequent encounter for fracture with non-union, P is subsequent encounter for fracture with a malunion, and S is for sequelae. Now, keep in mind that these extensions, the seventh character extension, can actually change within the different subcategories. So you always will have to refer back and make sure that you check your seventh, seventh digit, check your seventh digit. We'll now have to say check your seventh character because of the alpha characters that are contained in it. But you can see we have a displaced fracture of a shaft of the last clavicle, initial encounter for a closed fracture, S42.022. We need that seventh character captured, so the code now becomes S42.022A. Here's another example that we have for you. A patient underwent surgery for an open burst fracture of a lumbar vertebrae, which became unstable. So in this example, we have S32.012B, and that seventh character B in this subcategory actually identifies the initial encounter for the open fracture. Here's where we can get into some greater level of specificity. So think fracture of a clavicle. A clavicle is really just one long bone. We had one choice for it in ICD-9-CM. We have 24 choices for a fracture of clavicle found in ICD-10. So in this instance, our documentation has to include laterality, whether it's displaced, anterior or posterior displacements, or non-displaced. The location, is it the sternal end, the shaft, the lateral end, or is it unspecified? We'll also need a seventh character extender, which in this example could be either A, B, D, K, P, or S. So for an example of the anterior displaced fracture of the sternal end of the right clavicle initial encounter for an open fracture, we have S42.011B. For the malignant neoplasm of the breast, when we talk specificity, there are actually 54 choices found in ICD-10-CM for both the male and female breast. So our documentation actually has to include laterality, the location or the exact site, the use of an additional code to identify estrogen receptor status. And we give you an example there of the malignant neoplasm of the upper outer quadrant of the left male breast. So in ICD-10-CM, now keep in mind that the codes are in draft format, but the code now is C50.422. For our large and small intestine, we actually have 26 choices available, and our documentation actually has to include the specific site. And you can see that I have listed all of the different sites that are covered under ICD-10, such as appendix, cecum, colon, rectum, and we go down through to the jejunum. So in our example, we have a malignant neoplasm of a splenic flexure, and that's C18.5 in ICD-10-CM. Now, I like to use the example on this slide as a really good example of the physician has good documentation here, but the concept has changed in ICD-10-CM. So you can see where we have that it's a foreign body in a nose. And the patient is a 3-year-old who comes in after having put a raisin in her left nostril, and her grandma was unable to remove it. And so the physician documents the raisin was grasped with the forceps and removed. And examination of the nostril fails to reveal any further foreign body or problems. Now, in order to code this in ICD-10-CM, and I have this slide up here to show you just an example, you can actually find this example on the AAPC website under our code translator. And basically, all we've done is taken the GEMS files that are available through CMS and put them in a user-friendly format so that you don't have to search through all of the text. So you enter the diagnosis code, which in ICD-9 was 932, and it will crosswalk you over to some of the different scenarios. Now, keep in mind the GEMS won't give you all of the matches that are out there or all of the examples, but it'll show you. I really like this example because you can see in ICD-10-CM I actually have two choices. So now I need to know whether or not the foreign body was in the nasal sinus or in the nostril, which we had the documentation of. I also am going to need a seventh character extender. And so here it shows us the initial encounter. But is it a subsequent? Think about for those of you that have worked in ENT practices or along that line, sometimes a physician isn't able to get it on the first attempt. And sometimes they have to go back or put them under. So you have to kind of take a look at those different types of scenarios to see what was the actual encounter. Was it initial? Was it subsequent? What was the encounter? I also like this example because you can see the actual code for that is either T17.0 or T17.1. Those two X's that you see are considered dummy placeholders in ICD-10. And that's so we can keep the code integrity and actually put that seventh character extender. So on those code situations where we don't have seven characters and we need that seventh character extender, we have to use a dummy placeholder to order to keep that code integrity in place and keep it together. So let's talk a little bit now on what you can do now to begin to prepare for ICD-10. As Denise said, this isn't a quick fix. ICD-10 is going to take a lot of time and effort in our practices, and we have a lot of competing things going on in our practices that are getting our attention now with EMRs, stimulus monies, the things coming down in the HITECH Act, and those types of things that are kind of competing for our ICD-10. We want to make sure that we keep ICD-10 on the forefront and begin to work with it and integrate it with all of those other areas that we're working on in our practice. So at the AAPC, we have what we consider 16 steps for successful ICD-10 implementation. So your first step is really going to be to organize your implementation effort. If you're in one of those larger practices, this is where you're going to get your committee together and you're going to take a look at what's going on down along. If you're in a smaller practice, it might just be you and the doc. Then you're going to move on and you're going to develop your communication plan. Again, when you're in those larger practices, the communication plan is very important. In the smaller practice, this could be a simple staff meeting, meeting with the doc after hours or before hours, whenever you can get the time. You're going to conduct your impact analysis. Now, for those of you guys that work in practice management or have ever done some type of practice management review in your office, this is where you're actually, normally we would take the patient and we would follow the patient the whole way through the office and basically find out where you have gaps, where things are falling down, where everything has being touched. You're going to do the same thing with that process, only now you're going to replace the patient process with a diagnosis code. So you're going to actually take a 360-degree review of your practice and figure out where all diagnostic code impacts or touches your practice. And that's going to be your impact analysis. Then you're going to organize, especially if you're in those larger practices, your cross-functional efforts. In the smaller practices, this step would not be necessary. You're going to work on your budget development, and the budget development is going to be important no matter what size practice you're in. For your internal systems design and development, keep in mind if you use an outside vendor for your IS or your IT, you want to make sure that you're on their time frame and that they have a good understanding of what's going to come down along the way with ICD-10. This is one of those areas where if you use external sources, you want to make sure that they're going to be available for you when this change happens. Develop your training plan. You're going to contact and work with your system vendors and make sure that they're on track for everything. Then you're going to begin your implementation planning. Step 10 is your Phase 1 training. Now, Phase 1 training is what we refer to as you're going to learn the fundamentals of ICD-10. You're going to learn the format, the structure, the history, how the code sets interact, those types of things. But you're not going to learn the code sets in depth. Then you're going to take a look at all of your business processes and how those interact in your practices. Phase 2 training, this is where Denise said, you know, you don't want to get it too soon. You want to wait until six or 9 months before implementation. This is where you're going to get your specialty-specific code set training, where you're really going to become very familiar with working with your code sets. And you want to make sure you take that training just in time because it's true. If you're not using it, you're going to lose the knowledge. You want to make sure that you can work with it and that you continue practicing with it after you've learned it in depth. Once you get through those phases, then you've got to take a look at all of your policies and whatever changes might need to be made to those and down along the way. It's really important that anytime we implement such a large change, which ICD-10 is going to be one of the largest changes to ever hit healthcare, that we have some way to measure the outcomes. Is it what we expected? What improvements do we need to make? Those types of things that come down along the way. Step 15 is really just that deployment of the code. So any changes that we need, any vendor solutions that we're going to use, this is when the vendors are going to give it to us and make sure that it's in a user-friendly format. And then we're going to do our testing and make sure that we can do work with our fields and all of that that comes down along the way. And, of course, step 16 is going to be our go-live, our implementation compliance date. which of course we all know is October 1st of 2013. Now, AAPC has a lot of resources that are available on their website. We have lots of news articles, frequently asked questions where you can go in and find information. We have our code translator, which uses the GEMS codes to take your ICD-9 codes to what selections might look like in ICD-10. We also have a benchmark tracker that's available. This benchmark tracker is a really important tool for you because it goes down through those 16 steps with checkboxes so that you can go down along the way to make sure that you strategically hit that October 1st, 2013 go-live date. And this is just a sample of what our benchmark tracker is. So you click on any of those steps, and then that will give you what all you should be doing during that step, and you can check it off, and then that's what's going to change the colors for you. Green means you're good to go. Yellow means you're caution, you're falling behind. And red means that you're really behind and you really need to step it up in order to get your compliance in. We also have training options that are available out there. We do not have code set training available as of this time because it's not time. The focus should be on implementation of ICD-10 in your practices. And, of course, we have resources that are out there. We do have links to the CMS websites. They have great resources that are out there. As Denise mentioned, you want to make sure that you always go to your trade associations, your doctor's associations that he belongs to, your state medical societies, and those types of things to see what they have in mind and how they can help you prepare as you go down along the way. And, Alexis, that's the end of my presentation if we want to start up.
Great. Thank you, Rhonda and Denise, for your incredibly informative presentations. Again, I just want to just give a quick reminder that the presentation, transcripts and audio, Q&A will all be available on the CMS website within about 2 weeks following this presentation. Before we begin the online Q&A with the AAPC trainers that are available, I'm just going to go ahead and cover off on a couple frequently asked questions. I'm going to jump into that with Denise and Rhonda. Is there any possibility that the transition deadline for ICD-10 will change at all?
Hi, this is Denise. I can answer that. Right now, we have absolutely no reason to believe that the dates are going to change on either 5010 or ICD-10. Those dates are firm, again, January 1st, 2012 for 5010 and October 1st of 2013 for ICD-10.
Great. Thank you. Are there any provider groups who will be more affected than others by the transition to ICD-10?
This is Rhonda. There are some provider groups that will be affected more. Obviously, family practice or internal medicine because they use a larger subsection of the codes, as well as orthopedics, cardiology. Those are practices that have some changes that are coming down along the way that require a higher level of specificity and a different, more intense use of the code set, so they would want to take a long, hard look at the impact.
Okay, great. Now, there are a lot of competing priorities for healthcare providers right now with the High Tech Act, among a whole bunch of others. Why do providers need to make sure that they still keep ICD-10 kind of on their radars and their agenda and really start planning?
This is Denise. I can take that one. As I think I mentioned before, when we first developed both 5010 and ICD-10 regulations, a lot of the initiatives that we're looking at now, such as meaningful use and some of the ATA regulations that are coming through through the system, weren't even, you know, a twinkle in our eye, so to speak. But I think that there are a couple of things that are really critical to remember. Number one, they're mandatory. This is not an either-or. This is by regulation, and we have to adhere to it. Number two, these are really foundational. You can't have really meaningful use without the kind of robust patient encounter information and data that the ICD-10 code sets are going to generate. You're not going to have administrative simplification and streamlining of a lot of the business processes of healthcare that could really save the industry a lot of money if you don't have a system like 5010 that really provides more robust information and gives people up front the information they need so that they're not calling back the plans, they're not spending time on the phone, they're not having to resubmit more information. So I think that while, you know, again, a lot of this is coming down all within a very short amount of time, the first one out of the gate is 5010 and ICD-10, and they really will help further down the line as we get more into carrying out Congress's intent to really streamline the operations of the healthcare industry and to use the resources that we're currently spending on that segment of the industry and putting it more towards patient care and making it better for providers and for payers to get reimbursed fairly and properly and timely.
Great. Thanks, Denise. Participants, we're now ready to move into the Q&A portion of the Codeathon. If you look at the current slide, you'll see some instructions for asking questions. So I'll just kind of walk you through the process. You'll select the Q&A tab at the top of the menu bar in gray. Type your question, click Ask, and an AAPC trainer will then take your question. You'll see a pop-up box appear notifying you that your question's been answered. Please keep in mind that the same AAPC trainer who answered your first question may not be the same as the one who answers your follow-up question. So just be sure to try to explain your question in detail if necessary. And then throughout the whole session, the Q&A session is going to be followed, this audio portion, you'll be able to see answers to questions asked by your fellow attendees on the Q&A tab. So please feel free to review that to see if maybe your question has been previously answered, or just kind of feel free to watch the Q&A happen and kind of soak in all of the information. Again, we will be posting the slides, the audio, transcripts, the Q&A to the CMS website within about two weeks, so feel free to check back for all of the materials. So at this part of the presentation, our audio portion is going to conclude. The web portion will remain live for online Q&A. As I mentioned, you'll be able to type your questions. You're now free to hang up your phone and start typing your coding questions, and the AAPC trainers will be answering them as quickly as possible. Thank you all for your time, and again, feel free to check the ICD-10 section of the CMS website for the audio, the slides, the transcripts, and the Q&A. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may now disconnect.